You're certainly aware that the engines were going. That's one of the noises that you're accustomed to hearing, that you knew that the vessel was still turning ahead. Is that correct?
No, I'm not sure about that. In other words, no one told me specifically the engines are going ahead. I know that they were going ahead from reading reports and things that, you know, have come out. But at that time, no one told me the engines were going ahead.
Was there any discussion about maneuvering the vessel to attempt to get it off the shoal?
Our original discussion was that the stress and everything, the stress and bending moments were exceeded, that the stability was still fine. There may have been a moment of time there, maybe 10 to 20 minutes, where, as you all call, getting off the rock may have taken place or may have been attempted. I do not know for sure. But by 0100, the information that I was giving the master would indicate to me that the vessel should stay where it was at.
Okay. On any of your trips to the bridge, did you attempt to ascertain the position of the vessel?
What do you mean by that, Commander?
Did you take a fix?
No, I did not. No.
Did you look at the radar?
I glanced at it, but I didn't take a fix or anything like that. the first thing I did was look in the radar to see where land was in case I had to get in a lifeboat and where it would be bearing.
When you looked in the radar, did you notice any ice on the radar?
I did not look for ice. So, you know, in this period of time, I was not looking for ice. So I can't confirm that I did or did not see ice.
Did you notice any aids to navigation when you were out on deck or looking around? Did you?
Yes, I noticed the flashing buoy ahead. I'm not sure where it was now. But basically, I was not looking for aids to navigation, to be honest with you.
Did you see any ice in the water?
No, I did not.
Near the vessel?
No.
That night or the next, what about the next day or next days while you're still on the vessel?
I saw ice off in the distance on a couple days. The day we floated the vessel, I saw horrendous amounts of ice. Ice as big as half of this room from the top, from what I could see. That was the day that we left the area. And not being a Valdez sailor, I do recall some of the people who had been to Valdez a number of times saying it was the worst ice they'd ever seen.
I have some questions concerning alcohol or drug consumption aboard Exxon vessels or Exxon's policies concerning it. Is there any policy, either written or verbalized, that require Exxon employees to report abuses of alcohol or drugs?
Not that I'm aware of.
Then how does the Exxon shipping company find out about abuses of alcohol or drugs?
That would be the master's responsibility, from what I would understand. The senior officers would, you know, they would be required, if they saw something abnormal, to report it to the master and then have that passed on to the office.
Have you ever been asked in any application or any of your personnel records to disclose any arrest for alcohol-related traffic accidents?
No, I haven't.
Do you know if there's any provision for that?
No, I don't.
When you arrived up in the chart room immediately after the grounding, did you look at the chart at all?
I don't think so. I don't think so. This is when we actually, when I heard the shutter, was that my initial?
Any time in the first, say, 4 to 6 hours.
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. You know, sometime during that period of time, I looked at the chart, yes.
Do you remember what any fixes or anything that were on the chart?
Well, I do recall fixes on the chart, yes. Where they were, no, I don't. I was more interested in where we were, and there was a fix right there on the reef. That was the one I paid attention to.
Do you remember a fix, a beam of Busby Island?
I remember some fixes proceeding to that point. I can't tell you, yes, I saw a fix, a beam of Busby Point, but then at the same time, I can't tell you I didn't see one. Right?
Were there any other marks on the chart besides those fixes that you recall?
Yes, the lines had been drawn in the lane. I remember seeing them. No, I don't think there were any other marks.
Did you have any post-casualty conversations with cousins or the master concerning the cause of the grounding?
A couple. I didn't have any conversation with cousins after the grounding. Greg was rather upset. He was still doing his job and everything, but I didn't speak with him. I asked the captain, you know, what went wrong, and he said, well, they had voided ice and didn't make the turn soon enough. And that's pretty much the extent of my knowledge of what happened.
There was some discussion yesterday about vessel maneuverability, especially in shallow water. A term called a vessel squat that occurs when you're in shallow water. You also indicated that you had maneuvered vessels with only 2 or 3 foot clearance. Would you explain what the term squat means and how it affects maneuverability?
My knowledge of the subject is that if the vessel speeds up, she tends to squat down, and therefore excessive speed would actually increase your draft in shallow water. That's my understanding of it.
What would be considered shallow water for a vessel of this draft, say 50-foot draft?
That's a hard one to say. I mean, you know, any time there's a possibility of going aground, you're in shallow water. In other words, if I was proceeding in a muddy channel with 5 or 6 feet underneath me, I would, you know, regulate my speed accordingly. You're pretty much asking me, in my opinion, Commander, to give extensive ship handling type answers. My experience really isn't that I'm only a chief mate. I haven't proceeded. I have a master's license, but I have. I just can't answer it, to be honest with you.
Thank you.
Would you expect squat to occur in water of over 300 feet?
From my opinion, no.
How would you describe the maneuverability of this vessel with the load conditions that it had?
Well, my experience with this size of a vessel is very limited. From the people that I have talked to, their comparison to other vessels of this size, they were very pleased with it. I can only compare it to a smaller tanker, which would be like the Exxon Lexington. And she is very maneuverable compared to this big ship. She's only 240,000 barrels is what she carries. So those are the only two I can really compare my experience on the smaller vessel. And the smaller vessel, of course, was much more maneuverable.
When you give a helm command, say right 10 degrees rudder, how long do you expect, would you expect the vessel to continue on its course before it starts to turn?
Well, I would assume that that would depend on the speed and the amount of rudder that I gave the ship.
Say 10 degrees at 12.3 knots.
Well, I have no, I can't, you could get three or four people here and they would all give you a different number. If you really want to know the answer to that question, I think the best thing to do is get on a sister ship of that class and go out and do it. I mean, and that will give you the precise answer. But I can't give you the precise answer, I'll be honest with you. I would assume that the ship at 12.3 with a 10-degree rudder, she would respond in short order.
Short order meaning 10 to 20 seconds or 30 seconds?
Well, if I didn't see anything happening within 15 to 20 seconds, I would be concerned if something wasn't right.
Thank you. Did the captain ever talk to you about drinking that evening prior to coming aboard the vessel?
No, he didn't.
Have you ever seen him drink aboard the vessel?
I don't ever recall seeing him drinking aboard the vessel.
Thank you.
Okay, sir.
Dr. Laresh, I assume you have one or two questions?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I have five or six. Let me. Let me ask the one or two most pertinent ones.
Not yet.
Okay.
I think we've been here for, and Mr. Kunkel's been on the stand now for over 2 hours. I think we all need a break. Let's take a 15-minute break, and we will come back.
50.
And you can ask your questions. We will be back at 5 minutes to the hour.
We'll be back with more live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board hearings into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez in just about 15 minutes. You're listening to live gavel-to-gavel coverage of these hearings from KSK Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Corey Flintoff. I'm here with Bruce Melzer monitoring the hearings. This has been an interesting morning, Bruce.
This has been a very interesting morning, a very different picture of what happened aboard the Exxon Valdez and what people were thinking on board the Exxon Valdez emerged this morning. Yesterday, a lot of the testimony was incredibly unemotional. You got the sense that the crew on the boat was, Greg Cousins was clearly upset that he ran the ship aground, but for the most part, people seemed fairly detached. And then we get James Kunkel coming on board and saying for the first time he was feared for his life.
Yes, he feared for his life. Also the sense of what this means for everybody's career. He said earlier that he realized that once he walked into the cargo room and saw that the cargo depth was down, that this was a real disaster and that his life would never be the same afterward.
And in fact, he bumped into the master and at one point the master, Joseph Hazelwood, said to him, this is one way to end a career. Hazelwood had no doubt as to what was about to happen to him, having lost his tanker and started a major spill. Hazelwood was pretty clear what the consequences were going to be.
Actually, Hazelwood, assured Kunkel that his license would probably be all right. He said, you were asleep. So in essence, saying, don't worry about it. We'll do the best we can now. But certainly aware that his own license was down the drain.
Kunkel painted a very interesting picture of what happened after the accident. He himself was awoken by the accident. He said he heard it, other people may not have, but he heard the sound of metal scraping and stretching and spronging and things like that. Other people had not reported that. And as first mate, it's his responsibility to listen to things. He said he was up in a moment and wandering the decks. He went back to his cabin at various points to try and calm down, but said he would end up, after he'd done everything he needed to do, he'd go sit down for 10, 15 minutes and get up and walk around and try and check on everything all over again. We saw some other interesting things. It was Kunkel, who was responsible for trying to assess the structural shape of the ship and where the cargo, the oil, had gone, whether it had gone out, whether it flowed between the various tanks, and there we know from the transcripts and from the questions and from the Captain Hazelwood's own conversations with the Coast Guard that Hazelwood made some maneuvers to attempt to get it off the rocks. Kunkel said he didn't have first-hand knowledge of that, but he made it clear that by 1 o'clock, when he had done his structural assessments, that the structural shape of the boat was not good, that its stability was in question, and he thought it ought to stay put. And what is clear is that from this testimony that Hazelwood tried to move the boat without having adequate information about what kind of shape his boat was in.
We had a good, actually, inner look at the workings of this kind of thing, and apparently the first mate has a computer that he can actually plug in and see the condition of all the tanks, at least see how full they are. One of the most horrifying things that he mentioned was that when he first walked into the cargo room, he looked at a pair of radar gauges and saw that, I believe at that point, things were down already 10 feet in some of the cargo hold.
He said at that point he knew there was a real disaster on his hand. The phrase he used was, to my horror. He more than anybody else we've heard from so far, got the sense of how bad this thing really was. He's a man who's in the position to know, but he put things together real quickly. The other interesting thing is, of all the people we've heard from, he's the first one who's expressed thoughts about his own personal safety. He said several times he didn't know if he would see the light of day. He called his wife at one point on the telephone, and when they asked him whether he what he looked for when he looked out, he said he'd checked the radar position. He said he looked for land to see if they had to get in a lifeboat to see where he would have to go to. And the other crew members had not expressed any type of sentiment like this.
You know, he described, too, what probably was one of the most perilous situations when he went back up to the bridge to talk to the captain and show him the printout from his computer. He said that at that time the petroleum fumes were so strong that he almost felt that he should have brought a respirator with him. There evidently was some talk about fire prevention, but he said that there was no announcement even that people should not smoke during that time.
So there's some real questions raised about safety on board the vessel and decisions that were made. The other part of those fumes is that he said that he did not smell alcohol on Captain Hazelwood's breath because of the fumes. It sounded he could not smell anything except the fumes. And time again, he repeated that he had no knowledge of any alcohol use on board the vessel, did not detect or know anything about possible alcohol use by the master, and so it has not added any more information in terms of any questions about Joe Hazelwood's alcohol consumption and whether or not it happened.
No, although in fact we did get a glimpse of some potentially very damaging information on the part of a transcript of information given by the ship's radio operator, who says that he was invited to drink with the captain. That question was put to Chief Mate Kunkel. He said that he'd never had an invitation of that kind, although he did add he said, to my recollection, which is a little strange in response to a question like that, the questioner referred several times to the fact that the radio operator had evidently claimed to have had such an invitation. There are a couple other things of a kind of a personal, emotional nature that we didn't hear before. Kunkel said that in the following day when they were on deck and the Coast Guard people were arriving, he talked to the next witness, as a matter of fact, Lieutenant Commander Thomas Falkenstein, the Marine Safety Officer from the Coast Guard in Valdez, and that Falkenstein was the first person he'd talked to who expressed concern about the condition of the people on board the vessel. He asked how Kunkel was and how Kunkel's people were, whereas the concerns he'd heard from other people were, how much cargo have you lost? How much oil have you spilled? That was evidently the real first fear that everyone had.
And he expressed a great deal of thanks and gratitude to Falkenstein for making those kinds of comments and expressing that concern. There was also, after the wreck, he spoke with the captain as to whether or not they ought to sound a general alarm and alert people. And the captain at that point decided no, that they would send people around to tell folks what happened. But he said the captain's attitude at that time was to try and keep people as calm as possible and not to spur any real rapid action while they tried to assess the situation. You get the sense of the captain standing on the bridge with information sort of floating into him from the pump rooms, from the chief mate, running up, handing him information, this sort of thing. So that's the picture that we have of what happened on the Exxon Valdez on the night that it went aground on March 24th.
There was some more questioning on the part of the Coast Guard's Commander Waldron about the fact whether or not they were following Exxon's own standard operating procedure. Once again, a reference to that operating manual that they carry on board the vessel that specifies that they're supposed to be in something called watch condition C when they're leaving port in confined waters. And that watch condition C calls for two officers on the bridge. It says normally one would be the master and the other would be the officer of the watch and a lookout posted. Waldron asked the chief mate what he considered to be a lookout posted, and Kunkel hedged a little bit. He said, well, normally I would consider it to be a lookout as far forward and as low down as possible, namely a lookout in the bow. But under certain circumstances, he'd consider a lookout on the wing of the bridge to be sufficient. That, of course, is what they had. The lookout, Maureen Jones, was in fact on the wing of the bridge, although I believe the third mate, Gregory Cousins, said he didn't consider the weather to be bad enough to take someone off the bow.
And the understanding is that it was Captain Hazelwood's decision to pull Maureen Jones, the watch, the person on watch, back instead of putting her on the bow. And so there's some question about whether Exxon was whether Exxon was following its own procedures. We'll be back with more live coverage of the NTSB hearings into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez at about 10:55. I'm Bruce Melzer. With me is Corey Flintoff. Coverage of these hearings come to you from KSKA Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. And he is here. He is here on behalf of Exxon. And they may be getting around to him. The kinds of questions we've heard from the National Transportation Safety Board, we've heard questions from Eric Sanger, who is the human performance specialist. He tends to ask a lot of questions about alcohol, about fatigue, about what are the kind of conditions that people are operating under and what types of operating conditions affect their performance. We also hear a lot from Mr. Leon Kacharian, who is the Marine Accident Investigator, and he has led off with a lot of the key questions of trying to establish sequences of events and who's responsible. We've also heard during the course of this hearing from Mr. William Woody, who is the investigator in charge, and sometimes he sort of switches off with Kacharian in terms of taking the lead role of the questions.
And Bob Loresh is up next. We're just there returning Mr. Kunkel to the stand, and they should be just about ready to begin again. Bob Loresh, of course, is representing the state of Alaska. He said he had about five or six questions for the chief mate. It'll be interesting to see.
Dr. Loresh,
here we are.
Some questions for Mr. Kunkel.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kunkel, are you aware of any information that the ship would be required to convey to the agent or anyone else in Valdez after leaving port but before leaving Prince William Sound?
I believe that there is normally a radio transmission. What the content is, I'm not exactly sure.
What makes you think there is this radio transmission? How do you
I've never left port without, you know, checking in with the agent before you left. So I'm assuming that this was done here, too.
Okay, checking in before you left port.
Mm-hmm.
How about after you left port? Is there anything that needs to be conveyed to them?
Yeah. You've got a departure message. Time of departure. You've got your next arrival, speed that you plan to make, you know, your ETA, next port, speed you plan to make good, maybe any vessel requirements that you may need on the next port. that's a possibility that you would want to put that in the message also.
How long would it generally take to put together such a message?
I really can't answer that because I've never made one up.
You told us that when you felt the grounding or heard the sound, whatever, that you grabbed your survival suit. You also told us that
after,
that on being on the bridge and smelling the crude oil fumes, you thought very seriously of grabbing an MSA or a respiratory device.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you or did anyone else discuss with the master whether or not the crew should be similarly alerted to provide themselves with this kind of equipment?
Yes, I did. I discussed with the master.
And what were the results of that discussion?
Well, in regards to which piece of equipment?
Start with a survival suit.
Okay. I grabbed the survival suit because as chief mate, I knew I would be extremely busy, and I might not have the time to go back to my forecastle to get my own suit. I might be involved in actually getting other people off the ship, and that's why I took my suit. Everyone has their own survival suit right in their quarters, so it would be senseless to tell them to get it and then walk around with it because they were in their quarters anyway. Now, in regards to the MSA, that on the bridge area, the fumes were bad, but it wasn't that overwhelming smell like it was inside the passageway. And on my next trip down, it had dissipated.
Okay, thank you. Back to the loading or the stability computer.
Okay.
What kind of readout did that give you? I mean, the important thing, the way I understand it, is to have the ratio, the MG or BG ratio, whatever it is, at or above one.
That's correct. Right.
Does this give you a readout to how many decimal places?
Two decimal places.
Okay. But you said you looked further into the figures mm-hmm. and saw the calculation that something that should have been no higher or lower than 15 point something was right close, so you determined that the stability, that the ship was marginally stable.
No, that's not what I determined.
Okay.
I determined that the vessel was not meeting or marginally meeting required stability. Therefore, in my best estimate, the vessel should not go to sea in its current condition. The ship was still stable. We had positive GM. As long as your GM is positive, the ship would be considered stable. But due to the regulations, you are not allowed to go to sea on a ship unless you meet the required stability. And that's what the program in the computer is designed to do, is to issue you basically an order, and it says this is what you must have. And if your load doesn't meet this, as a chief officer or as the master, you cannot move the ship.
So the computer, is it correct to say the computer only gives you a go or no-go decision?
Well, no, of course not. In regards to what?
Does the computer readout, the one you told us about first, being close to one at two decimal places,
mm-hmm.
does that give you any idea of how close you are to the limits, or does it just tell you you're over them or under them?
Oh, no, it gives you the actual number. You can make your own comparison also.
Okay.
I mean, yeah.
Thank you. You had, you said in your earlier interview with these guys that you had, I'm sorry, with the National Transportation Safety Board staff. He was referring to you as these guys earlier, Mr. Chairman. That you have recalled observing...
Excuse me, could you tell me what you're reading and where?
Yeah, from your interview, page 2, under personnel. Under
what exhibit do you have?
Oh, boy. 6B, Mr. Chairman. six Bravo.
Hey, what are you using for page number? The bottom one or the top number?
The number that is typed in the center of the bottom of each page.
Okay. We're in the same world now. Okay. Let's go.
You had observed Mr. Kagan in the past steering through the Panama Canal, the Houston Ship Channel.
Yeah, let me read this here. Okay. The lights are pretty tough.
Just that first paragraph under personnel.
Okay.
Yeah. The Panama Canal, the Houston Ship Channel, and the Santa Barbara Channel. Those, as I understand it, are places that require fairly precise steering.
It requires a competent steersman, yes.
Okay. And from observing Mr. Kunkel do that, was he competent? Mr. Kagan do that. Okay. Was he a competent helmsman?
Mr. Kagan was able to steer the ship the whole time I was. Mr. Kagan was able to steer the ship the whole time I was aboard in all of those areas, and there was no mishap. Therefore, Mr. Kagan steered the ship all right. Okay. I don't ever recall having to take the wheel away from Mr. Kagan, if that's what you need to know.
Yes. Also, to follow up, you said you're quoted in this exhibit that's before you. That Mr. Kagan does the best he can, but you have to watch him.
That's correct.
Did you ever discuss this having to watch Mr. Kagan with Mr. Cousins?
I believe we had discussions in a very informal manner, but then we have discussions about all the ABs. I make it a policy to talk with my watch officers, who have a much more closer relationship because they are on watch, and there is always a discussion about the unlicensed personnel with the junior officers.
Do you think that this discussion you had with Mr. Cousins regarding Mr. Kagan may have caused Mr. Cousins to pay more attention to Mr. Kagan than he would to another helmsman?
Dr. LaRiche, that's probably a question you should have asked Mr. Cousins. I think all we know here is that Mr. Kunkel did have a discussion with the third mate.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Another question. Was Mr. Kunkel, in your experience, Mr. Kagan, I'm sorry, sir, in your experience, capable of putting in counter rudder to come to a course without being ordered directly to do that?
I had seen him do it on the other ships that I was with him. I had never seen him do it here on the Valdez.
Had you seen him do it on his own initiative or only in response to an order?
Well, probably to an order, I would assume.
Okay.
In other words, I'm not quite clear on what you're saying. In other words, a ship is swinging to a heading, and the ship is swinging to a heading, and I want him to come left, but he's going to do it without me ordering him? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Is he going to give counter rudder for a short time in order to slow the swing of the vessel?
Well, that's normal. That's normal. In other words, if I've given the helmsman a heading order, I expect him to issue whatever rudder is necessary to get to that heading.
Yeah. If you had just given the helmsman, Mr. Kagan, in this instance, a rudder order, do you suspect he might have corrected, given counter rudder as we're using it here, without having been given a heading?
Okay, I've given him a rudder order. Like an example, would you give me an example?
20 degrees.
20 degrees what?
Right.
All right. I've ordered him to go to 20 degrees right.
Now, what is the question?
And you haven't ordered him to come to a heading. After observing Mr. Kagan in the past, do you think he may have checked the swing of the vessel on his own volition without being ordered to do so?
I would doubt it.
Okay. Do you still have this computer-enhanced course indicator?
Is that for Oscar? Appendix B? Appendix B?
To Echo Attachment C, I believe, Mr. Chairman. It's the largest of the blow-ups.
The witness on the stand is the chief mate of the Exxon Valdez, James R. Kunkel. He's responding to questions from the state's representative, Bob LaResch. Once again, there's a brief pause while everyone makes sure that they're looking at the same exhibits. There's a long list of exhibits and documents that are being used here.
Basically, this is the same course recorder, but computer enhanced to be even larger, the way I understand it.
Okay.
But I would like you to look at times 0905 Zulu on this chart. Look at that one first. Would you interpret that as a ship that has, as the heading indicator of a ship that's been given a little counter rudder? See the little squiggle in there? The rate of turn slows down briefly at 0905 on this chart.
Well, what am I looking at? I mean, what exactly are you telling me to look at? This right here?
You're looking at the course line at 0905, course indicator line.
Okay.
And it changes in slope.
Is this right around heading of 310 to 300 in this area? That's crossing that, or what?
Yeah, it's between the 310 and 300 indicator on the left, and it's, say, between 0904 and 0906 in that block.
Are you asking Mr. Kunkel
to analyze this course recorder and try to interpret this course recorder or try to determine what could have happened or what would have caused this? If that's your question, he cannot do that.
Okay. I was asking him as an expert in interpreting these charts as he did at length for the commander.
Okay, I don't think I was an expert or that the commander ever assumed that I was an expert. I was just giving you my opinion, and I'd be happy to do that again. I don't quite understand what you want me to look at.
I want you to look in the quadrant between 0904 and 0906 and between 300 and 310 degrees. And it appears to me there's a deviation in the rate of turn, which is smooth before that and after that. And does that comport with the helmsman checking the rudder during this turn?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
I really
Thanks.
Can't. I don't know.
You said that you had some personal discussions with the master after the ship had come aground, in which he said something to the effect that this is a heck of a way to end a career. The master, at about that time, had told the VTS that he had a problem with his third mate. Do you know what he might have meant by that?
Well, first of all, I don't know if my conversation and talking to the VTS took place at the same time, sir. Okay, you said about that time.
Within an hour of that time.
Well, let's say within a day, okay? I mean, within a day, that day. I don't know what he meant. I don't know, because I really wasn't there when he made that statement.
Okay, thanks. When you were asked what a lookout meant to you, you quoted the Coast Guard collision regulations almost verbatim, I think.
Right.
The call regs. Are you well versed in those regulations?
Well, the regulations are always on the bridge for you to refer to. And I'm not going to say I'm well versed at them, but I know where they are and I know how to obtain them and I know how to use them.
Okay. Can you quote me the Exxon alcohol on board vessel policy verbatim?
Well, of course not.
Okay. You said that in training you had been told or led to believe that, quote, an officer's job is to see the policy is followed.
That's my perception.
Were you told that in so many words in any of these courses?
I'm not certain of that. I assume that as an officer aboard the ship, that is part of my responsibility.
In any of these training courses, did the company educate you in methods as to how you could see that this policy was followed, techniques to use to be sure this policy was followed?
No, I've never been given any training in that.
And how did you, assuming that was your responsibility, how did you ensure that the policy was followed on your vessels?
Well, if I ever saw someone turning to go on watch or to do a job that appeared to be staggering or something along those lines, I would assume that he wasn't up to his full potential. And then I would, of course, notify the master. That would be my procedure.
So you're assuring the policy was followed occurred after the fact and not in a preventative manner?
What do you mean by that?
I mean that you answered how you assured the policy was followed. You wait till you saw somebody drunk and then enforce the policy. Did you ever give your crews lectures or courses on this policy so you were sure they understood?
I never personally did, no.
Okay, thank you. You said earlier that prior to 0100, you've explained this two or three times, you recommended to the master that the vessel was not stable.
No, I recommended to the master that we did not meet required stability and that I would recommend that he stay in the area.
Okay.
Not leave the area.
Stay in the area. Does that mean?
Those were my exact words. And
what did you mean?
I meant stay where we are.
Stay where you are. Okay. And after that, the fact is in the record that the master ran the engines and issued repeated rudder commands for the next 41 minutes. How can you explain that in light of the fact that you consider the master an excellent captain?
Well, I can only speculate. I don't know.
Would you please?
The vessel stayed where it was, so whatever he was doing must have been right.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Cook.
Okay.
Captain Deppe?
We have no questions, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Mr. Colucciello?
Mr. Kunkel, did you at any time following the grounding compile a chronology of list of events that you recorded as to your activities or what you saw that related perhaps to your duties? Did you make such a chronology?
After the grounding?
Yes.
No, I don't think I did.
You wrote no notes about the to yourself or to kind of recall the events for a later time?
Mm-hmm. No, I did not.
All right, sir. With regard to the computer calculations that you did, both for stresses and stability, did you feel confident that the program was suitable for the situation that you were in?
Well, I have never used it in this situation. I felt that the instrument was giving me enough data to make an honest decision, and that decision was to stay where we are. I felt, based on the data I had received and the fact that we had so many tanks moving, that we should stay where we are.
Well, I'm talking more specifically about, say, in the case of the stability. Do you know if the program was written for considering the vessel was afloat and not grounded with an upward force?
Yeah. The program has different sections in it. You can look at it in an intact condition. You can look at it in a grounded condition. And it also has a damaged condition that you can input into it.
In the case of determining its stability in the grounded condition, did you have to put into the program the location of the ground and perhaps the new drafts or something to show what extent you had an upward pressure on the keel?
Yes, you had to put in new drafts, and I believe that was it. I'm not sure. You had to put in some new drafts.
I see. You did not have to locate the position at which it was grounded in order to make the program work?
I can't recall. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. In inserting the data to show the loading, did you at that time also enter what had flooded into the ballast tanks?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
And do you input that as all oil, or do you input it as seawater or combination?
At the time, I put it in as water because I thought that it was water coming into the ballast tanks, and that was the medium that I used.
In calculating the stress portions of the that you are doing, does the program require you to indicate loss of metal or cracking of metal or what areas that this has occurred in?
No. I think, sir, what you're getting at is this computer is a normal shipboard operation computer. For the kind of damage that we have on that ship, I don't think it is capable of a complete calculation, if that's what you're trying to get at.
Well, I was trying to find out, how confident you were about the information you were giving the master at that time, and subsequent to that, your present feeling of how applicable that program is for the situation you are in, whether or not at this time you know that information really had no valid basis because it was just totally not designed for the situation you were in. You may not have known that at the time, or that may have been the best you had, but I'm trying to get a feel for how good was that information at that time.
At that time, that was the only information I had available, and I felt it was good enough to make a decision, because by going in an intact condition, i.e., no damage whatsoever, it told me that I was not meeting required stability. So therefore, I knew that if all things were well, I was still not meeting required stability. That was my first indication that we needed to pay close attention to where the vessel went.
Does the computer actually give you values in as far as stress is concerned in stress numerals, or what kind of an output is it in? What are the units?
I'll have to read it again.
Well, if you don't recall,
it gives you stress numerals and it also gives you percent. In other words, 100% stress. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that would be what you would normally, as a chief mate, pay attention to, the fact that as long as you stay within 100% plus or minus, you're okay. Mm-hmm. But it also does give you the stress numerals.
Before you leave port, do you run a stress calculation in the normal course of events? Do you do this also during the loading and unloading?
Yes.
I see. On a different subject, you were discussing and telling us what rate you lost oil and when you lost the oil. Do you believe that if the inert gas the pressure had been removed from the inert gas system, do you believe that this might have reduced the amount of oil spilled?
No. Mm-hmm.
Did you observe if the loss of oil was related to the tide conditions? That is, when you on each low tide, did you begin to leak oil again?
No. From my recollection, after the first low tide, we became very stable as far as the discharge of oil. And any leakage on the following tides was either minimal or a sheen or none at all. Mm-hmm. It's my perception that within one cycle of the tide, the output of oil had ceased.
Mm-hmm. It has been said that in tankers like this one, designed like this and going aground, that if the if it does puncture the bottom and oil leaks out, the ship then becomes lighter, and on the next high tide it floats off and can proceed. It didn't happen that way in this case. Can you give a reason, you think, why this didn't happen?
Well, because I don't think the ship got lighter. In other words, the ballast tanks filled up and offset a lot of that weight. The forepeak filled, two starboard and four starboard pretty much filled. So granted, it did get lighter, but we didn't get that much lighter. It wasn't as if none of the weight had been replaced.
You think that if the forepeak and the segregated ballast tanks had not been punctured, that you would have lost whatever you were about to lose, and that therefore you then would have been perhaps gotten off the ground?
I really don't know the answer to that. I'd have to, Mm-hmm. You're hitting me with some very hypothetical situations, and if you'd like me to, we can sit down and try to figure them all out. But I can't, in the top of my head, answer questions like that.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Mr. Kunkel. When we originally brought you up here, you described the vessel itself, its characteristics, and you said that basically once the vessel is loaded fully, the draft is 64 feet.
Yeah, that would be load line draft?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
For this particular voyage, loaded as it was, did you mean by that to imply that that was the draft on this as she departed the port?
No, sir.
Do you happen to know, or do we have the information as what draft was as she was proceeding?
Approximately 56 feet.
Thank you, sir.
Within 2 or 3 inches, 56 feet.
That's it. Mr. Kunkel, I just have one or two for clarification. Some of our people and some of the parties have asked you questions about the captain, about Mr. Hazelwood, and you said that you did have a few conversations with him on the bridge that evening or that morning following the occurrence. I think you were asked by several people, did you smell anything on Mr. Hazelwood's breath? And I think you responded by saying no, but there were other vapors in the air. Did Mr. Hazelwood ever say anything to you about him drinking or about him having a drink?
No, sir.
At any time in the past, have you ever known of Mr. Hazelwood saying to anybody else on crew whether or not he has had a drink?
I'm not aware of him saying anything like that.
Okay, thank you. Let me ask you just a couple of questions on course recorders. We've had a lot of discussion about Exhibit 2 Echo. How accurate are these, in your opinion, how accurate are these course recorders? Timing and heading?
Well, what would you like me to compare them to?
Well, let me ask a question a different way. How are they maintained, or when are they maintained? Or are they recalibrated? Or are they just calibrated once?
The second mate would normally be responsible for ensuring that the course recorder is recording the course. Are they calibrated?
How does he ensure that they're recording the course accurately?
Well, he checks that the gyro and the needle agree.
Okay.
That they're actually putting that on the paper.
In relation to, are they just calibrated once initially?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by calibrated. Every watch, you have to check it before you take the watch. That's standard routine. The first thing you do before you take the watch is ensure that the gyro and the course recorder agree.
So in other words, if there was some question yesterday with Mr. Cousins about the possibility of 6 or 7 or possibly 8 minutes difference between when some commands were given and when the heading seemed to change, if I remember that correctly. In your opinion, you don't think that there could be a 5-minute lag which could account for something like that?
I would assume, yes.
Yes.
That the course recorder should show what took place in 5 minutes?
That the course, my question is there any, without asking it that way, my question is, if a command is given and the heading changes, the course recorder should show that subsequent to that change, or should it show that immediately?
If the heading is changing,
that's correct,
it should show it right away.
Thank you. Mr. Kunkel, thank you for your time this morning. You're excused.
Aye, sir.
I'd like to call the next witness to the stand, Lieutenant Commander Thomas Falkenstein,